run a quiz and I didn't offer you chocolates, you'd probably all get up and walk out. So seeing Peter Elliott has started this unfortunate tradition, I feel I must continue it. So I'll wait till everybody's got a piece of paper and a pen, because it would be unfair to those who are still digging in their bags not to have a chance to see the first question. And Bevan has generously offered me an extra 10 minutes I didn't ask for, so I can happily talk till 11 o'clock and keep you all bored. Okay, are we all ready yet? There are pens, yes, coming round. And everyone, if you sit on a chair, it should have a piece of paper on it. Okay, this is question one. Question one. Until which year? I am a historian, but I'm not a church historian, so when it was suggested to me that I might do this talk, in fact, I might do three talks if I'm not thrown out of the church for this one, I went to my friend Nathan Hobby and I said, has anything recent been written on the history of the church in Australia? Because I've got books on the history of the church, but they're all getting pretty old. And he said, no, nothing recent had been written. The only book he knew was The Bible in Australia, A Cultural History, which I recommend by Meredith Lake. I bought it, I read it, I found some really interesting things out about like how heavy the Bible was that James Cook brought out to Australia on the Endeavour, which I thought I might ask you, but I've decided not to. Does anybody have any idea how heavy it would have been, actually, in terms of kilos? The Bible that James Cook brought on the Endeavour. Four is the closest. So you can have a chocolate, Jenny. Okay, so into the serious quiz now. Until which year all Christian marriages except Quakers had to be solemnised in the Anglican or Church of England? Which year do you reckon it was? 1816, 1836, or 1876? It's in England, but it affected Australia. Just write down the number one and the number that you think it is, and we'll go through the answers at the end. Okay, who's ready for the second one? So, which Australian colony was founded by religious dissenters? Was it Western Australia, Victoria, or South Australia? Okay, third one. The first church in Swan River Colony, or Perth, was known as St. George's Church, the Rush Church, or the Magistrates' Court. Fourth one. To what did preacher James Jeffreys refer as being high treason against God and man? Was it the Immigration Restriction Act, otherwise known as the White Australia Act, in 1901? Was it the Churches Acts of 1836 to 37 that granted significant government aid to non-Anglican churches? Or was it the 1861 New South Wales Supreme Court ruling that the Anglican Church didn't have precedence over other Christian churches? Next one. On what memorial in Western Australia will you find the words, greater love hath no man? I'll give you a clue, it's not in a cemetery. And lastly, an easy one that anyone as old as me should remember, and that is the Uniting Church in Australia was formed in which year? 1956, 1967, 1977. No, don't put your hand up, just write something down. Okay, are we all done? Who had B, 1836? Okay, so a few people there. You all get a chocolate. Which colony was founded by religious dissenters? South Australia? Who said South Australia? Yep, but you all get a chocky as well. Who knows what name the original church was known as? It was the Rush Church. It was in Hay Street, what's now in Hay Street Mall. So who got that? Now, I'll talk a bit more about this because the Magistrates' Court was actually the second church in Perth. Now, what about this one? To what did preacher James Jeffreys refer as being high treason against God and man? Who thought it was number C? Who thought it was number B? It was actually number A. Yes. Yeah, well, I'd surprise you. No, I think it was very good that he said it was a high treason against God and man. He's talking about the act of the bard. Non-British, non-white people from living in Australia. And I was surprised that at that stage there was enough concern about it to make that remark. So, yeah. So maybe there were a few people in the church that realised what they were doing. So, the next one. Anyone know what this memorial is that has this inscription on it? Greater love hath no man. No. 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 What? The dog's home. That's a good one, actually. I think that should be there. It's the memorial to Tom Edwards, working class martyr who gave his life on Fremantle Wharf on the 4th of May 1919. And it stands in King's Square. It's a drinking fountain, and it's the plaque that says, that's what it says on it. Because he got hit on the head by a policeman and his skull was fractured during the wharf riot when they were protesting against scab labour on the Fremantle Wharf. Right, now, the last question. Which year was the Uniting Church formed? How many people had 77? Nearly everybody. Okay. So, before we hand out any more chocolates, did anybody get... Nobody got six, I take it. Who got five? Anybody get four? Oh, well, looks like you're going to have to divide. Okay, now, to the serious business. Right, all quieting down? It seems to me that Australia is a country of religious paradoxes. When I began studying Australian history, I kept reading statements like, by the 20th century, Australia was a secular country, and scholars gave the impression that religion was, if anything, if important to individuals, that it was a very private matter and it really didn't impinge much on public life. They pointed, for example, to the popularity of secular war memorials. You know, the soldier resting arms is probably the most popular war memorial in Australia, and the interesting one out at Midland, which is actually a Grecian figure of peace, but not many religious images, they said, were on war memorials. One thing that they did overlook is the fact that Australia's premier war memorial, which is the one in Canberra, is built in the shape of a cross. And also that some war memorials depict soldiers as Christ-like figures, and that sacrifice, that the sacrifice is certainly a common word used on war memorials, which equates soldiers with Christ laying down their lives. Almost all of our prime ministers have at least nominally been associated with a Christian denomination. And one researcher has checked them out and said of 27 prime ministers from Barton to Gillard, John Warhurst has concluded that at least 18 have either overtly or nominally belonged to a Christian denomination. However, a high number of agnostic and secular prime ministers when compared with British prime ministers and American presidents. I don't know that any American president would dare to say that he was an agnostic or an atheist, as Whitlam and Gillard certainly did. And, of course, our current PM is proudly Pentecostal. Happy clappy. Warhurst concluded, however, that the role of belief or non-belief is still considered to be an important factor for voters who seek to understand a prime minister's character and actions. And, for example, some of you may remember when Gough Whitlam stopped the practice of commencing each day's parliamentary proceedings with a disgracefully gabbled Lord's Prayer. People thought that the world was coming to an end. They really complained. When you actually heard the way they said the Lord's Prayer in Parliament, I said, so he should. If you're going to say it like that, it's just going through the motions. It doesn't mean a thing. And, of course, there's evidence of sectarianism playing considerable role in politics, and I put up there the Great Labour Schism, because, of course, it was religion that played a part in dividing the Labour Party in the 1950s, which helped keep Menzies in power for so long in the 50s and 60s. It's not surprising that about one-third of Australia's prime ministers have been Anglican. When the British colonies were established in Australia, the Church of England, or the Anglican Church as we know it now, was the only legal form of Christianity. There were many restrictions on Roman Catholics and nonconformists, including, as you now know, that Christian marriages had to be solemnised in an Anglican church and until 1836, by which time colonies had been founded in New South Wales, Tasmania, Victoria, Western Australia and South Australia. Now, I've only got half an hour or so because I don't want to keep you from your lunches, but I'll try and touch on three main issues: the church and state, social impacts of the church, and a bit about personal belief. I'm not going to be talking about mission or Indigenous communities or the church's impact on it today, because I thought I'd reserve that for another day, and then another day, still another day, I'll talk about churches and war and how the church has responded in wartime. Okay, so the church and state, and I hope you don't find this too dry. As in England, the Anglican church and the state were seen as being closely connected. When Governor Phillip arrived in Port Jackson, he was required, among other duties, to arrange for Anglican services to be held. The first chaplain was Richard Johnson. That's one of those questions you get on quiz night sometimes. Who was the first chaplain in Australia? It wasn't Samuel Marsden. It was more famous. It was Richard Johnson. The Anglican church was closely associated with the ruling authorities. Almost all governors in the early colonies were Anglican. And as an example, the first Catholic governor in Western Australia was Weld, and he came in 1871, which was 42 years after settlement. Governors dispensed the law. The state served the Anglican church, and the Anglican church served the state, as Tom Stannage has written. Perth's first church was a little rush building with a thatched roof, which was erected in time for Christmas 1829. During the week, it doubled as a magistrate's court. Until the courthouse, which is now the Burt Law Museum and the Supreme Court Gardens, was built in 1837. So that's the oldest standing building in church. The church was held in the courthouse then until St. George's Church was completed by 1842. So church, the law, and the law were closely identified in the eyes of the colonists, and especially those who fell foul of the law, the extremely harsh laws of the time, and these were mainly working people and ultimately, of course, convicts as well. The need for priests to attend the Roman Catholic flock wasn't recognised, although there were actually three priests among the Irish political prisoners transported to New South Wales after the rebellion of 1898 in Ireland. One of these was James Dixon, who was pardoned in 1803, and he was permitted to work as a chaplain, actually with a government salary, until he was accused of being complicit in the Castle Hill risings involving Irish convicts in 1804. Other priests worked clandestinely, but the church was not recognised until 1820. Anglicanism, in fact, was a more prevalent feature in the foundation of Australian colonies than convictism. So don't believe it when people say, oh, you were all descended from jailbirds, because out of all Australian colonies that started as convict places, neither Victoria nor South Australia nor Western Australia were founded that way, only that lot over on the other side, Tasmania, New South Wales, and ultimately Queensland, which became a separate colony in 1859. And I'm old enough to remember the centenary celebrations. So, Anglicanism, that's the main feature of the colonies, the main binding feature, similar thing in common of nearly all the colonies. South Australia, the paradise of dissent, as it was known, was founded mainly by nonconformists and even included a Jewish man, Montefiore. And there's a Montefiore Hill, people who know Adelaide will be aware, overlooking the town, topped by the statue of Colonel Light, who probably was an Anglican. Whereas the other thing about South Australia is there was a significant number of German Lutherans settled there. It was actually settled as an entrepreneurial colony, and they brought people out who were not normally British, and that was about the only colony that wasn't exclusively British, pretty much up to the gold rushes of the 1850s. Originally, there was much debate about whether the Anglican Church would maintain the status that it had in Britain, where it was regarded as the ecclesiastical part of the realm, whose doctrine, discipline, and governance were defined and regulated by Parliament. In New South Wales in 1825, the Church and Schools Corporation was endowed with, this is pretty mind-boggling, 1/7 of the land already colonised was given to the Anglican Church to maintain its schools and its clergy. Just the Anglican Church. Reforms in England, brought about largely by nonconformists and Catholics being admitted to Parliament, changed the status of the Anglican Church from being part of the state to being a partner with the state. But the changes in Australia were much greater. Church Acts in New South Wales and Tasmania in 1836-37 granted significant financial aid to non-Anglican churches. So within 10 years or so, that changed from the Anglican Church being the only church that got any money off the government to non-Anglican churches. And some governors resisted the power of the church as well, most notably when the bishops of Tasmania and New South Wales tried to enforce ecclesiastical law by which they could set up courts and actually try people for crimes. New South Wales Governor Burke's Church Act of 1836 provided government grants to Anglican, Catholic, Presbyterian and Methodist congregations to build churches wherever there were settlements. So they then got the same treatment as the Anglican Church in terms of being able to fund churches. In 1861, and this is the important one really, the Supreme Court of New South Wales ruled that the Church of England had no precedence over other religious groups. Now, as I understand it, that's not only just other Christian groups, but anybody, Buddhists, Muslims, whoever, other religious groups, and that English ecclesiastical law had no force in the colony. All religious associations were equally free to practice before the law their preferred faith, provided they didn't breach the general law. So if you didn't do anything illegal, you were free to practice your faith. By the end of the 1860s, even state aid to church schools had ceased, and it wasn't restored until well into the 20th century. But while ecclesiastical law ceased to have legal power over church members, the churches remained of powerful moral influence in determining values and influencing adherence. So now I'm going to talk about the social impacts. The Christian Bible came to Australia in an imperial context brought by British colonisers, who regarded it as the word of God. And here's a quote from Meredith Lake's book on the Bible. In profound ways, Meredith Lake says, the Bible helped to shape the very dynamics of British colonialism, whether it was transporting convicts, appropriating Aboriginal land, or forming settler societies. The Bible and the church were integral to colonising and imperialism. The first fleet arrived with hundreds of Bibles, hymn books and prayer books, tracts and catechisms in its cargo. Their sins were daily impressed upon the convicts, although nothing was said about the morality of a society that let children starve and then penalised their parents for stealing in order to feed them, though I acknowledge that many convicts committed far worse crimes than stealing bread, but some, indeed, children were sent out here for stealing bread. Convicts often received a free Bible at the beginning of the voyage, and it was noted that they usually took good care of them and even read them, if indeed they could read. But not so with other Christian literature. On one voyage, the surgeon noticed a group of convict women sitting on the deck of the ship unwrapping their curling papers. Does anybody remember curling papers? Yes, you wrap your hair up in paper at night, and in the morning you'd take it down and hope there was a ringlet there. Afterwards, he was horrified to find many fragments of religious tracts blowing about. Until the withdrawing of government aid from schools, churches were strongly involved providing educational facilities. In the 1870s, various acts mandated that education should be free, compulsory, and secular, although the Catholic Church resisted this by continuing to run its own schools. Until well into the 20th century, churches also provided a main form of welfare. For example, in World War I, governments initially gave little thought to the needs of discerning service personnel who were temporarily or permanently handicapped and unable to work, or indeed to the dependents of the deceased, and I'll talk about that more if we go on to have a talk about the churches and the war. It was only when it began to realise the extent of the problem that the federal government established the repatriation department. Similarly, widows, old age and handicap disability pensions were non-existent until well into the 20th century. War widows pensions, I think, was the first one to be established. Many people were dependent upon church charities to survive, but of course they could only do so if they could prove that they were respectable poor. So have you ever known that you were down the pub with the demon drink, or a woman had been seen with a strange man, and or she'd been leaving her kids to play in the street? Instead of looking after them, she got knocked off the roster for help and of course sank into even more poverty and depravity probably, but that was it. Sober, respectable people had to be the people who were helped. As settlement spread to the interiors of the colonies, the churches also had the problem of how you reached colonies that were beyond the churches, beyond settlement. So the Anglicans established the Bush Brotherhood, young unmarried novice priests who travelled in the outback. And these operated from the turn of the 20th century until, quite surprisingly, the 1970s. They still had Bush Brothers in the 1970s. My mother used to talk about the Bush Brothers coming around. And they weren't even terribly isolated. No, I don't think so. They were usually young priests who just graduated, and they'd go out and hold services or go and talk to people in their homes. And I think they could conduct weddings and funerals. I assume they could. Yeah. Oh, presumably they couldn't keep the dispatches too long, man. And he'd come and do a service over the grave. Yeah, yeah. Oh, wow, yeah. Reminded me a bit of the mailman and We're the Never Never that used to wait till he turned up with a whole lot of mail, but I suppose it was... All right, yeah. The Presbyterian minister John Flynn, I don't know how many of you know this, but he founded the Australian Inland Mission in 1912, And one of the things he noticed was how hard it was for people in the outback to get medical service, and he was instrumental in forming the Flying Doctor Service, which was then in outback Queensland, but now, of course, it's everywhere, you know, the operator of Jandakot here. One of the themes of Lake's study of the Bible in Australian culture is that individuals often respected the Bible, but much more than the churches or their servants. And to some extent, I think this was evident in congregations. Anglicans, who were suspicious of episcopal power, developed diocesan, provincial and general synods. So in other words, they were pretty keen on governing themselves. They were saying, why should we be governed by some guy that we hardly ever see? So this spirit of self-help, I suppose, and looking after yourself. Congregationalists, of course, were even more democratic, with each congregation being effectively self-governing. The first congregational church was established in Sydney, with congregations forming in most colonies in the 1840s. The Methodists had a similar history, and I forced you to sing Methodist songs this morning, partly because songs like that were what some of these churches would have been singing. What a Friend We Have in Jesus, and Can It Be, Over a Thousand Tongues. You know, the Cornish tin miners brought Methodism to South Australia, but it also, a lot of South Australian miners came to Western Australia in the gold rush, and although the labour movement's often been associated with Catholicism, actually quite a lot of Methodists in the labour movement and other non-conformists. So it's not just, you know, Irish Catholics that were in the labour movement by any means. And, of course, they brought with them ideas of self-improvement, the working men's libraries, and hard work. And, you know, hard work would be rewarded by not prosperity theology as we understand it today, but you worked hard, you earned money, and you shared your money. You gave away to people. That's where the prosperity theology people fall down, I think. They work hard, they may work hard, they get a lot of money, and they don't necessarily give it away. In 1977, of course, the Methodists, the Congregationalists and most Presbyterians merged to form the Uniting Church of Australia. This is a uniquely Australian development that has not occurred in other countries. In the same year, an interdenominational Australian hymn book was published, and the Anglican Australian Prayer Book was published in 1978. And I think these moves suggest that the church is finally coming of age. We have a church that is unique to Australia, and we have prayer books and hymn books that are unique to Australia rather than keeping on borrowing from the British roots. And I presume with the Lutherans, with German roots, because I haven't really said a lot about the Lutherans, but, you know, it's an idea that there's an Australian church rather than we're all still Church of England or descended from those traditions.
There were two Lutheran churches that were very different. They united in 1967.
All right. Yeah.
But in other places around the world, that those two ethnicities haven't always come together. They can be quite divided.
Because in Britain, there's the Reformed Church, which is an amalgam of several churches. But yes, it's something different from here. Now, of course, one of the things that's been a contentious issue, particularly in the 20th century, was women, whether women could lead church services, as some of you will remember from our own church history. Well, why was it? The prohibition of women speaking in church is often based on Paul's instruction to Timothy that women should learn in silence and humility. I do not allow them to instruct or have authority over men. They must keep quiet, from 1 Timothy chapter 2. But, of course, this attitude to women descended far beyond the church into all aspects of society, and that's one way in which the church tends to influence much wider society, is that women were kept out of professions, medicine, law, even studying at university. And in Australia, Sydney and Melbourne both started as unisex universities. Women were not allowed to study there until they broke down the gates, basically, almost physically, and demanded to be allowed to study. Uni of Western Australia and the other more recently founded universities were co-ed, but the early universities were not. In countless instances, women's fitness to perform any task in public life has been judged by those words purportedly from Paul. For Adam was created first and then Eve. It was not Adam that was deceived. It was the woman who was deceived and broke God's law. It was Adam that was deceived as well, of course, but we weren't, you know, they never mentioned that. Yet not all churches maintained this attitude after the beginning of the 20th century. And I actually have a feeling, and some of you might know, that some of the more fringe churches from America had women ministers in the 1800s. I used to have a book that mentioned this, but I think I might have chucked it out when I left Curtin. So does anybody know about some of the Pentecostal churches where they had women ministers back in the 1880s or 90s?
I know the Salvation Army had women officers very early, and they liked to part of their story, how early they were.
Right. So did they preach?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Right. And do they still do that? Okay. Right. Well, I remember in the bad old days when we were fighting with the Presbyterian Church, and I can't remember now whether, I think this was at Carawarra, is one minister said, you can't have women elders because in the Presbyterian Church the minister is just the teaching elder, so if women are elders, there's nothing to stop them teaching. That was their logic for women not being elders at that time. Anyway, up on the slide I've put some firsts. The Congregational Church were the first people to make a woman in the main, what you call mainstream denominations, I suppose, to ordain a woman in Adelaide in 1927, and then Isabel Mary in 1937 in Melbourne. Methodist Church in Perth and Coralie Ling in Melbourne in 1967. And the Presbyterian Church, interestingly, ordained a woman in 1974. And then I've got, obviously if the Baptists don't ordain, maybe that's wrong that I've put it under the ordination, but the information I was reading it from said they were ordained, but they were appointed. So by 1977, at least 33 women had been ordained in those churches, the Churches of Christ, Methodists, and so on. And by the time the Uniting Church had formed, the 33 women were in the churches that united, so 13 each in Congregational and Methodist churches and 7 in Presbyterian church. But, yeah?
Am I correct that that's more women than have been in Australian parliaments by that
stage? That's very likely, yes. I mean, I was actually on a pre-polling booth the other day, and we're always told that we shouldn't engage in robust conversation with the opposition. But this woman came down who's standing for Mount Lawley, and she was going on about how the Liberals had done all this stuff for women. And I said, oh, well, why don't you have more of them in Parliament then? Because, you know, they are a bit notorious about not having... I mean, I know that Labor doesn't have as many women in Parliament as it should have, but the Liberals are worse. So anyway, that's what I said to her, you know, why don't you have more women in Parliament then? She laughed. But, well, I'm trying, she said, to get myself into Parliament. Or at least, and particularly in Cabinet positions, not just in Parliament, but when they get into Parliament, getting into Cabinet's another thing altogether. Now, here's the interesting thing, is that although the Uniting Church continues to ordain women, very few have been in the church, other church leadership positions, and at the point time that this research was done, there was only one female national president of the Uniting Church in the first 12 that were elected since its foundation. Continuing Presbyterian Church, you won't be surprised to see, rescinded its permission for women to be ordained in 1991, and in 2007, actually, the General Assembly tried to ban women from becoming elders, but interestingly, it wasn't supported by a majority of state assemblies. So it's nice to know there's still a little bit of sense in the continuing Presbyterian Church. So, yes, but they seem to be different from the particularly conservative brand that we've got here, though. Because I think when the Uniting Church was formed, it was only the very conservative branches of or congregations of the Presbyterian Church that stayed out, because there were some, in fact I assume a majority of the Presbyterian Church joined, because there were not that many congregations here.
So this congregation was on the far progressive end, and there was others on the conservative, and they could join us. We had here, I guess, was being part of the continuing tradition, which we were, you know, the centre had been taken, and we were everyone else.
Well, I remember the minister that came to Carawarra, whose name was Don Lark, and his wife said, if you could ever imagine a greater mismatch than him with our church, you couldn't imagine it. So she was perceptive enough to see that we just got someone who was extremely conservative. But, of course, he would have fitted into... No, he didn't actually. He didn't even fit in at Bicton in the end, so... poor man. But so the Catholics, of course, still steadfastly refusing to ordain women. But in some 179 parishes around Australia at that stage, there was no priest, and religious sisters provided a parish ministry. Between 1993 and 2009, a lobby group for the ordination of women existed in Canberra, but it seems that it found the task too daunting because it actually folded in 2009. Things may change. The Catholic Church is now desperately short of priests, and it's been estimated that in order to adequately serve congregations, the number of Catholic priests in Australia would have to increase. How many do you think? The number that's existing now, how many more would they have to have? How many times would it? 20-fold at least, to have a priest in for every congregation. So it puts the traditions of celibacy and a male-only priesthood under much pressure. Now, with the Anglican Church, they permitted women in some lay leadership roles between the end of the 19th century and well into the 20th, but women weren't ordained for another 100 years. The first deaconesses were appointed in 1884, and there was division between the dioceses that would regard them as ordained or would ordain them and those who appointed them but wouldn't ordain them. So women were elected in the diocesan synod in Perth from 1921, but not in Sydney till 1972, and it wasn't until 1978 that women were admitted as church wardens in the Sydney diocese. In 1969, the Australian General Synod declined to give deaconesses clergy status despite the bishops of the Lambeth Conference, which is the policy-determining body of the Anglican Church in Britain, recommending it, but they didn't have enough power to say, you're going to do this, they recommended it, but the Australian General Synod refused. So in that case, we're more conservative than what was happening in Britain, and not really true to those roots that I told you about, where the churches were working towards autonomy. So it's worth noting that some of the movements, that, like the movement for the ordination of women, were formed in the 1980s and so on, had missionaries, former missionaries, among them. The church's attitude to missionaries seemed to be rather odd, and it was explained to me when I was in Kenya, somewhat cynically, oh, it's all right for women to come and teach the childlike Africans, but you mustn't have women teaching real men. So you could send them to Africa, any of these women who wanted to be a priest or a parson or a pastor, they could satisfy themselves going to the mission field. And the mission field I was on, the women outnumbered the men 10 to 1. The men were all married. The women were nearly all single. So that was the other thing, is women went out there single. Men nearly all went out with the support of a partner. So, right. Peter and I were in the church of one of the first women, Anglican women, ordained in Canberra. And she was quite elderly. Her name was Margaret. She's a lovely woman. She always started church on time, 9:30. One person there started. And we met in a school, a school building. And then there was another little church up at Hall that she used to minister to as well. And Kay Goldsworthy, the bishop in Perth here, was the first bishop to be consecrated on the 22nd of May 2008. So how has church populations changed? Well, according to the 2001 census, 68% of the Anglican population described itself as Christian, and of that 68%, 81% belonged to one of the three major denominations, Anglican, Catholic, or Uniting Church. And there in the same census, 11,415 men and 2,823 women identified as ministers of religion. There were 416 ordained women in the Anglican Church, but they didn't have specific figures for the Uniting Church. Yes, these are ministers of the Anglican, Catholic, or Uniting Church. Well, not the Catholic, but the women relate to the Anglican and the Uniting Church. The 11,000 relate to all three churches of those three. Now, waves of migration have changed the church, and by 1927 there were only about 10,000 Greeks in Australia, and they began setting up Orthodox congregations, but after the war, after the Second World War, there were waves of Europeans and later Asians. So 30% of the Vietnamese boat people or refugees who came here were Catholic, and Vietnamese priests and congregations are now impacting Catholicism. So first of all, Catholicism was pretty soundly Irish, based on the Irish churches. Then became much more Catholic, and you get the blessing of the fleet and Catholic traditions. And then you get the Vietnamese priests in Melbourne. And interestingly, comment is that much more than any other immigrant community, the Vietnamese have given their sons to the celibate priesthood of Roman Catholicism. And they say, perhaps nowhere else has the Vietnamese presence been more noticeable than in transforming the religious face of Australia. But what are some of the ways that religious influence is still around, even people who don't go to churches, people can think of? Yep, Christmas and Easter, yep, yeah. And what about the good old white wedding? How many people still want a white wedding in a church, even though they've... Well, it's church, so the idea of purity at marriage and that has become church tradition. So I'm not saying Christianity in particular, I'm saying the way the churches have influenced people. Ceremonial baptisms or christenings, marriages, funerals. Though a lot more people now have funerals that have no Christian content, but still a lot of people do. So even that few that go regularly to church, far wider population would have a Christian funeral or a Christian wedding. Now, the other thing that's influenced the church is events. And I'm wondering, who can tell me what this is? Billy Graham? Yes. It was 1959 at the Meyer Music Bowl. That was the first Billy Graham crusade. 3 million people were estimated to have attended. And at that time, the population was about 10 million. So, astonishing. 1959 crusade particularly has been described as the closest Australia has come to a revival. And I'm wondering whether anyone here has any memories of the 1959 Billy Graham crusade. Oh, interesting. You didn't stay with him, though, did it, really? No. See, this is one of the... Yeah, yeah. It's interesting because all these... thousands of millions of people turned up. And how did they judge it was successful? 10% reduction in alcohol consumption for 1960-61. A brief halt in the increase of crime. A fewer out-of-marriage births. Businesses, I like this one, the epidemic of repayment and bad debts. And the councillors at the Crusades, people were actually handing in weapons, thieves, burglars were handing in their jimmies or whatever, and crowbars. And one guy actually handed a revolver. I thought that was great. 50% drop in alcohol-related crime. And then in 1969, they reckoned that Melbourne Bible College and Adelaide Bible College students, percentages of them were influenced by the crusade. They'd either become Christians at the crusade or been persuaded to spend their lives as Christian leaders. And so on. I was quite intrigued by the way they actually judge the success of it. It's all about crime and not drinking alcohol and not being immoral and, yeah, and not so much about how many were still attending churches 10 years later or whatever. But now, it's interesting that this occurred just before that wonderful outbreak of promiscuity known as the Swinging 60s. And my hunch is that one of the other unfortunate outcomes of it is that whenever the Australian church thinks it's time for a revival, they think they need an American evangelist to lead it. And that's something that really, really disappoints me. The other great movement that will be closer to the memories of some is the Jesus Revolution. Now, I became Christian in 1973, and I don't think it was because of the Jesus Revolution, because it was in a very conservative Presbyterian church in New Zealand where they neither drank nor danced. And my experience was I then came here with the Methodists, danced but didn't drink. And then I went to England where the Anglicans danced and drank. So that was my progression into evil from the time I became a Christian. One Way Jesus, an interesting book has come out about the Jesus Revolution, but unfortunately it's all about America. I haven't read the book. I just discovered it the other day. Jesus was a Capricorn. Anyone remember that? Jesus was trendy. It was all about the pop singers like Kris Kristofferson. Jesus was a Capricorn. He ate organic food. He believed in love and peace and never wore no shoes. Long hair, beard and sandals and a funky bunch of friends. Reckon may just nail him up if he come down again. Who remembers that? Yep. Yes, you remember it. And, of course, the Jesus book. That's my souvenir from the Jesus Revolution. It's a version of the New Testament. It comes from the Living Bible. And that sticker was on my guitar, still is on my guitar, actually, though I haven't played it for many years. So I'm interested in whether the Jesus Revolution paid out in people's lives and whether maybe the Jesus Revolution was the roots of people leaving churches, because now there's a lot of Christians around who aren't in churches. So this is where we are now. It was estimated in 2013 Australia had about 13,000 churches, 1.8 million Australians attending church. That's out of 25 million, more or less, our population is approaching. 61% of Australians identify with Christianity, and the second most popular religion is Buddhism at 2.5%. But less than one in seven churches, Australians attend church regularly. And when people were asked why they didn't attend church, maybe the most concerning one is, it's irrelevant to my life, 47% who believe that. So I don't know what we conclude from that. I'll leave it up to you, basically.